Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is Mr. Chad Chewy Riley.
It's about the best I can do with no warning.
And with us also is Spencer Goose Williams.
Well, that's like the same thing, so I'm not going to do the same thing, so there you go.
That almost sounded Canadian. Like, all you had to do was add the A. Like, oh, so that's all we're going to do, eh? But if you have any idea where those two names come from, you have an idea of what we are talking about tonight, and that is Captain Marvel. So stick around as we jump into that. We got a chance to see the film, and we can't wait to talk about it. But before we do, Chad, give him an opening credits.
Alrighty, like some of your favorite jams from the 90s, the Filmlosophers podcast keeps coming back with new episodes each Wednesday on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom. Mm-hmm. Lest you forget, we're presented by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios.
Truth.
Don't get stuck watching cat videos online, or if you do, just don't tell us about it.
Please. Is that
don't.
What you were watching before the episode, Spencer?
It was not. Don't insult me. Unless you're ready to discuss Flurkins, those might be worth a chat. Check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. You can also head to the interwebs to review all our 150-plus previous episodes of The Filmlosophers. Just visit filmlosophers.com to refresh your memory about the many films we've discussed over the past 3 years.
That's right. We have a library. Like, before we've had a good amount, but now that we hit, like, that mark of 150 episodes, I kind of feel like it is a big deal. We got 150 episodes of content that we've talked about over the past 3 years. I mean, that is really awesome to me just to even think about.
It's really good. And we're out of our terrible twos.
Yeah.
That's also very true. And like Spen said, we got all these episodes ready for you to listen to at filmlosophers.com. You can catch up on the most latest episode, which was Lesson 152, where we talk about How to Train Your Dragon 3. So check it out after you listen to this episode.
It's just a lot of numbers.
It really is. But in terms of this episode, we are going to be talking about Marvel's Captain Marvel. This film has been one of the most anticipated films of the year, as a lot of people have been wondering when Marvel was going to debut not only this iconic character from the Marvel comic universe, but also when they were going to debut a female superhero-led film. For a long time, that mantle kind of belonged to Scarlet Witch as having her own one, or even Black Widow having her own film.
Which
eventually, yeah.
They're actually prepping a Black Widow movie now.
Oh, nice. Well, we finally get one put out by Marvel, and we got a chance to check it out this past weekend. It dropped in theaters, and needless to say, every single fan of the Marvel Cinematic Universe has been clamoring and roaring praise about the film. So we're going to give our opinions and talk about it a little bit here on the show.
Honestly, it's a little difficult because there are two major things happening mm-hmm. here. In the mind of like a true fan of the MCU.
Yeah.
You've got essentially Marvel's answer to Wonder Woman. Like Marvel's female-led, like, I don't need a dude to save me, I will save everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and have some sass doing it or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. So standalone on its own. But also it's the last film before Endgame.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So any kind of a clue as to what role she could play in that sort of like culminating experience in a little over a month, that's also a big thing.
Yeah. So before we jump into this, Chad, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness here?
Yeah. Carol Danvers becomes one of the universe's most powerful heroes when Earth is caught in the middle of a galactic war between two alien races.
There you go.
That was like surprisingly succinct.
Huh. Yeah.
And actually correct.
Well, when you're that, like, succinct, you can't really be that
just
wrong.
Just don't let him talk long.
Written and directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, Brie Larson stars as the titular character of Carol Danvers alongside Samuel L. Jackson, Ben Mendelsohn, Jemaine Hansu, Lee Pace, Lashana Lynch, Gemma Chan, Annette Bening, Clark Gregg, and Jude Law. This film, marking the 21st film in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, borrows elements from Roy Thomas's 1971 Kree-Skrull War comic book storyline, which we've actually talked about. I'm not too sure if it was this specific storyline or the storyline that was affected by this one, being Secret Wars, but we've talked about this at length with other episodes where Chad actually kind of
pretends to know what he's talking about.
He actually knows his stuff. So when it comes to conversations about comics, this is kind of his forte. But it's interesting to note that we weren't too far off the mark when we were talking about like pitching certain ideas and thoughts as to the direction they're going to go. So
I know, and they have such an interesting little like sleight of hand deal that goes on with this movie, but we'll get into it.
The Captain Marvel storyline for the character itself is based on Kelly Sue DeConnick's 2014 series, the Higher, Further, Faster storyline that she comes out with, which actually also debuts her most recent version of her outfit, her costume, the one that you see in the actual film. In an interview
with rock that mohawk, girl.
Oh, for real. Seriously. In an interview with Vulture, Marvel Studios chief Kevin Feige talked about how Captain Marvel was going to become the MCU's strongest player. He had stated, all of the Marvel characters have flaws to them. All of them have a deep humanity to them. With Captain Marvel, though, she is as powerful a character as we've ever put in a movie. Her powers are off the charts, and when she's introduced, she will be by far the strongest character we've ever had. And that says a lot, especially at a point in time where Marvel has already put in about 10 years worth of film and creating characters that have already their own backstory and have had time to build up to like a certain strength level where they're powerful in their own right. So to even after all that, get to a point where you say, well, yeah, we still have yet to reveal the most powerful key person in this entire cinematic universe, and this is who she's going to be. This is going to be that character. So I just think that's really...
It was a fantastic tease when he said it.
Oh, no doubt. Like, it's like I said, it's interesting to hear how everybody that you've already seen on screen, like, people love the Hulk, people love Thor, people love Iron Man, Captain America is always a favorite, and you see how strong they are and how much they flex and their muscles and abilities to be able to do certain things, and then to realize that all of them still pale in comparison to this one OP character that they have yet to debut.
Yeah, and that's after they turned Thor into the most OP character you've ever seen. Like, then immediately they're like, oh yeah, that guy, he's pretty good, but she's stronger.
Yeah, yeah. And it's just, I don't know. What do you think, Spence?
I think her power level is insane, and she's like basically the Marvel equivalent of a Super Saiyan minus a few random things. But I think it's just pretty interesting that they waited till this long to bring out such a strong character. I'm kind of curious as to why, though. Based on how, like, you know, the movie goes, because they could have done it earlier.
True. And we've had this, we actually had this conversation prior, so I want to dive
into
this conversation.
I will bring that back up.
Yeah, because this was a point of conversation after we got out of the film. I called Spence and I said, Spence, I need to know what you thought. And that conversation I should have recorded, because that was a good conversation. Real quick, budget of the film was an estimated $152 million. Its opening weekend, only in domestic box office numbers, hit close to $153 million. Obviously making it number one in the box office.
That's huge.
It literally made back its whole budget in one weekend.
Like, that's enormous. That's an enormous take for opening weekend.
And then you look at the worldwide opening, because it just debuted this last Friday. So worldwide, the film has done $457 million.
Yeesh. It's almost at half a billion already. In less than a week.
In terms of talking about Captain Marvel, just a heads up, we are going to be discussing spoilers in this review.
Gasp,
shock, awe, and everything else in between. We're going to be diving into spoilers because of the fact that we really want to have just that really great conversation where nothing is kind of held back, and there are certain things of the film that I actually want to get everybody else's opinion on here, especially Spence's, because like I said, Spence and I had that phone conversation, and I was kicking myself the entire time saying I should be recording this. But jumping into our thoughts and whatnot, expectations. Now, one of the things that is pretty obvious about our show is that we have kind of a track record to show a little favoritism for Marvel films, only for the fact that they've actually succeeded in creating solid superhero adapted to film movies.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. I mean, it's plain and simple. There's no, like, we have a favorite child or whatever or whatnot. That's not the case. It's just they keep putting out good stuff. I mean,
yeah, I mean, anything that you would have considered a misstep happened before this podcast began.
Yes.
Like a serious misstep, like Iron Man 2.
Yeah.
Well, we did review Thor 2, which a lot of people think is a misstep. But when you look at how Thor as a character fits into the overall fabric, it's a necessary misstep in some ways.
Yeah.
Because of what it sets up for the broader, you know, cinematic universe. But yeah, I mean, we've had some good ones, though. Some really, really good ones to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, just as of recent, you know, the Thor Ragnarok film, the third in that
individual. Amazing.
It was such a great film. I mean, as of late, we're looking at Infinity War. Infinity War was a phenomenal one. You know, Spider-Man, Homecoming. It's just...
Hello. Oscar-nominated.
Black Panther.
Oscar-winning Black Panther.
That's right. But I think it's safe to say that there's enough recognition in this studio, first and foremost studio, not even just talking about the film franchise, but in this studio coming out of the Marvel film aspect, Marvel Studios, to say that they're doing a really great job and they know how to create solid storylines to be able to translate to not just fans of the comic book versions of these characters, but also fans of cinema, fans of just movies in general. Because if you just have a movie that panders to only comic book fans, then you'd have DC. I mean, because essentially everything they've done...
Wow.
Everything they've done...
Burn.
Well, and so just real quick...
I would say that it doesn't even pander to their own fans.
Yeah, I feel like it
in
doesn't.
Some regards.
I just say that because we've had somebody whom we've talked to at length who has mentioned like, oh, well, yeah, it was a great movie for me because it referenced all these little things about the DC animated movies and the comic book runs and like this little part, like the way he turned this way is from this little panel from this comic book that nobody's read. And
so these movies are pandering to one person, it sounds like.
Pretty much. It's essentially.
In that one person's mind, yes.
But you look at what Marvel's done. And
sorry.
I can't even. If you know who you are, we're
sorry.
We love you. But you look at what Marvel has done. Marvel has continuously created and created and created great stories and great characters. The only thing they have yet to do is give a female superhero their own film. And that's where Captain Marvel comes in, which we had been hearing for some time, as we mentioned earlier. Black Widow was going to have her own film. They were going to have a film for Scarlet Witch, which they are working on a TV series right now for Scarlet Witch and Loki, I believe.
Separate ones.
And then, as we mentioned, they are going to be working on the Black Widow solo film later down the road. But we finally get the female superhero-led film that we've been wondering about, been asking about. So, in terms of all these 10 years of expectations for seeing a film like this, I want to know, how did you guys feel going into the film? Like, how did you guys feel knowing that this was going to be one of those films that not only people were going to be looking at as another Marvel film, but also as the iconic film that starts off the female-led portion of what they start pushing out from Marvel Studios? Because much like Black Panther was a very unique film as well, because it was more focused on not only T'Challa and his story, but also going away with the origin story formula and pretty much doing a full homage to the African culture, that being so unique. What were your guys' take on the expectations for this film? Let's go ahead and start with Spencer.
Wow. Well, really, I don't know anything about Captain Marvel. So there was like a whole just like the only thing I was vaguely aware of is like she had some dealings in like Civil War II in like the comic books. And that's the only real thing I've even heard her name mentioned with. Other than that, not much. So just going into this movie, I was just hoping they wouldn't make careless mistakes with her character mm-hmm. because there's nothing worse than like seeing like someone who's supposed to be super strong put into like some sort of damsel in distress like trope or something like that. So really I was just kind of like hoping to learn a lot about the character, and I feel like I did.
Chad?
Sure. I think that one of the things that's really unique about Carol Danvers, the human name that she doesn't even know when you first meet her in the movie.
Nope.
She doesn't know her human past. But I think the unique thing about her is that she's very headstrong, like to the point of being reckless. There are numerous arcs in the comics where she doesn't always make the right call. She always makes a decision with a lot of passion and a lot of heart and clear direction for herself. But sometimes, potentially including, you know, Civil War II, which you mentioned, Civil War I famously was Captain America versus Iron Man.
Yeah.
Civil War II was Captain Marvel versus Iron Man. And they were arguing over, essentially it was an ideology debate session, you know, played out with, you know, hero versus hero fisticuffs. But it wasn't the first time that she, like, she's the kind of character who is not afraid to go toe-to-toe with her allies and say, no, I see it differently. This is, you know, I will, if necessary, I will fight you until you see it my way. So there's a lot of, she's pretty much always had a headstrong component to her base personality. Have they sometimes featured her as more of the damsel in distress? Yes. She's like gone all over the place in the Marvel Comics universe. She's been like bonded to an alien and like psychically grafted with a personality. She's become an entirely other, like next level being and then back again. And you see some reflections of almost as if, you know, you can start foreshadowing some of those motif patterns.
Yeah.
Here, I mean, they don't go full on into, well, you're fully grafted with an alien, you know, DNA, or you're, you know, fully psychically imprinted with, you know, an alien way of thinking, or you turn into this other star-like creature. All of it's referenced, but none of it's like fully committed to, and that's because this is your first go round with her. So the fact that they're positioning the character as essentially your standard bearer for Phase 4.
Yeah.
You're meeting her now. She's going to play a role in Endgame, and she's going to come out the other side because they need somebody who kind of has that heroic, unapologetic valor of Captain America, but also that headstrong, not always agree with them sort of Iron Man component. And with her, very authentically, like when you're looking at the character in the comics, they didn't have to change very, they would not have to change very much to get both of those components in one package, one character, because she is often that way. She's extremely powerful. She's given a great measure of authority as her kind of broader story arc carries on through the decades, because she's been around for a very long time. Most of these characters have. You know, so it was, I was excited to see the movie primarily because I didn't know how they were going to mix and match and recombine all the different elements. I mean, you've got the 90s, which is a real head scratcher.
Yeah.
Young Nick Fury, you know, the whole pager that we saw at the end of Infinity War. And you've got, she is like beyond powerful compared to almost any other character we've ever seen. And then you've also got the Kree, which we've seen before, the Skrulls, which we have not seen before, the shape-shifting aliens. Mm-hmm. There's a lot that you could mine out of those stories, and it was a big question mark. How far are they going to go with any of this? Because, I mean, essentially, they easily could have set up another decade's worth of stories without us even seeing all the parts.
Yeah. Which, like we mentioned earlier, we've spoken at length about that option of going that route with pursuing more of the Skrull invasion and, you know, going into secret wars, talking about, you know, the Skrulls that have invaded in certain teams of the Marvel comic universe. And
oh, they'll get there.
Yeah.
They'll get there.
In terms of my expectations, I think one of the biggest things I wanted to make sure, because I don't have, much like Spencer, I don't have a lot of history with the character. Now, I can do the research, but reading all of like the issues she's been a part about and like and all the situations she's been, like I've read on the general gist of what has happened to her. Like, of course, her whole transition during the 70s, the mantle being passed down from, you know, Marvel, Captain Marvel, to her, and her getting like her origin, and then the really weird stuff that happened to her during the 80s, like you were saying, where she was that, just that whole situation where she was essentially taken off by some bad guy named Marcus. he's an evil villain. Don't look at me like that, Spencer.
Okay.
It's not Marcus from Next Door or anything. No. And then her comeback from during the mid 80s, and then her whole story arcs during the 90s, being a part of the Avengers, being a part of the X-Men team, being a part of different, you know, formats. And the only actual storyline that I've actually read is the most recent Kelly Sue DeConnick's run, because it just happened to be given to me in a box, like one of those kind of like Loot Crate. It was like a subscription box. Mm-hmm. It came in a comic book one like that, and it was the only Captain Marvel comic at the time I had ever read. So seeing how the current storyline, like I mentioned earlier, is based on that, I actually feel kind of good, because I'm like, oh yes, there's some kind of information I have I can add to Chad's conversation. Yes. But I think overall my expectations tend to run more logistically as opposed to story wise like my biggest hope was knowing that this film was going to be utilizing CG rendering for certain characters that were going to be de-aged and whatnot. I was wondering how well that was going to hold up during the whole film before we'd seen it happen, like at the beginning or at flashback sequences. And I just didn't know if that kind of, it's like holding a door open for somebody. Like, how long can you hold it open before it starts getting strenuous, or you start seeing like the cracks or whatnot. So that was one thing that I was really going to be paying attention
to. Or if, like Wolverine Origins, you give different effects houses the same character and some of them royally screw it up.
Yes. Where you get like a Roger Rabbit looking like claws coming out of your hand.
Terrible. Sorry, not to digress, but no, thankfully they don't do that here.
No, thankfully. Another expectation I had was knowing that this was going to be Marvel's first foray into, like I said, the female superhero-led film, I wanted to make sure there was going to be a very distinct difference in how Wonder Woman was portrayed and how this character is going to be portrayed. Not to say that they're going to copy each other and whatnot, but to say that I want to make sure, like, what I got out of Wonder Woman, it's unique to that Wonder Woman story. It's unique to that whole character arc. I'm not talking about, like, story-wise. I'm talking about the recognition of the female empowerment and the ability to, you know, see the power in that, in what she's doing, recognizing and respecting that. I wanted to see how Marvel was going to go about doing that, expressing that, and showcasing the power of the character, not just in her abilities, but in her, in who she is as a woman, as her, as Carol Danvers.
And they're very different characters. I mean, Wonder Woman, you know, she comes from an ancient culture, and it's, you know, all women, and so there, she doesn't know how to not be like the big personality in some respects.
Yeah.
In the room. She doesn't know, it doesn't matter to her what the societal expectations might be one way or the other. She's her own person. That's all she knows how to do.
Yeah.
You know, she's not encultured with, you know, whatever situation she steps out of the mist and into our quote unquote real world, you know, in her movie. And in Captain Marvel, you have a character who has had to rise above challenges.
Yeah.
And it's a theme that they, you know, delicately like push several times over the course of the film to show that she has been belittled, she has been thought less of, she has fallen down and gotten back up. So they personality-wise and experience-wise, they come from very different places.
Yeah.
You know, with regard to showcasing strength.
Yeah. And I think that's one thing, like, talking about just going into kind of some of the characters in the film, like, Brie Larson plays the titular character, as we mentioned. She plays Carol Danvers, or Veers, as they call her at the beginning of the film, because that's what she goes by while on this Kree planet. But you're also introduced to her mentor, which is Jude Law, who plays Yon-Rogg.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just introduced to this life that she lives on this planet. She's very much the troublesome child, if you will. Like, she's so troublesome that she has to have, like, a governor chip or something on her neck to help her keep her power in check. And so you see kind of how the role she plays within there. Like, she has to have a mentor. She has to have somebody who keeps an eye on her. Somebody's always worried about her. She's like the little sister that you're not sure is going to behave or not. And so you're introduced to the whole slew of characters on Yon-Rogg's team. One of the unique things that I was actually genuinely surprised about, because I know we're going to talk at length about Brie Larson, but one of the actual characters that I think really stands out for me was Talos, Ben Mendelsohn's character. Because it's interesting that we're so used to seeing him play either an American accented role or his somewhat British role character, like in Robin Hood. And I didn't know it until we actually did the research. I didn't know that Ben Mendelsohn is actually Australian. And it was kind of a surprise to me when he was talking his normal voice in the film, because he gets that opportunity to. You're like, oh, he speaks with an Australian accent. I almost said he speaks Australian. He speaks with an Australian accent. And I don't know. I was telling Chad this. I don't know if I've ever actually just heard Ben Mendelsohn. Like,
yeah, not in any of the mainstream movies
that
he's been in. And he's, unfortunately, he's largely played the same role.
Mm-hmm.
And so you,
in the same suit,
you expect him to, you expect him to play that same role here.
Yeah. And thankfully, he has a very complex story arc throughout the film that we'll get to. But him being able to showcase being more than just a villain and being able to sound like himself. Like, there is a very distinct difference from his heartfelt or more emotional scenes, like from Robin Hood or from Ready Player One or even from Rogue One, where he plays Director Krennic. There's a very, very big difference between the heartfelt scenes that he does there and the heartfelt scenes he does here without his focus on the way his accent sounds. Like, it's like worlds apart, and it almost seems like he's a completely different actor.
Yeah, performer. It's really refreshing.
Yeah. But like we were saying, you know, Brie Larson is the, oddly enough, she's the hometown hero for here. She's from Sacramento, playing the character role of Carol Danvers. One of the things that I wanted to kind of highlight about Brie Larson's character here is how innocent or naive I feel like she comes across, in a good way, because it seems like she doesn't really seem to be ready for everything that comes across, but she still wants to pursue it, kind of like what you were talking about earlier, very headstrong, very just like, yep, I'm going to go do it, don't worry, I'm fine, whatever. And it ends up getting her in certain predicaments already prior. And I feel like her ability to translate that kind of, and I don't know if it's intentional, in all honesty, I don't know if she's trying to or if it's just the way her performance comes across, but I think she really does that whole young, naive, coming into like the recognizing of the bigger world around her type mentality. I don't know. What did you guys think?
No, I definitely got that, especially in like the earlier parts of the film.
Yeah.
And I think that's mostly because she doesn't have, like, at that point in time, like, a real history to ground herself down to, like, you know, before she forgot who she was like an Air Force pilot for mm-hmm. like experimental stuff. But like once she's on the Kree homeworld, she's just a blank slate. from there. So I think that's really what causes her to be have that kind of naivety and innocence.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she knows it. That's one of the things that's really good, too, is that from the moment you meet her on Hala, which is not like Hala back, y'all, but it's the Kree homeworld. From the moment you meet her, she's aware that she's missing memories of her past. Like, she knows that she doesn't remember where she came from, which is great because it's unlike having somebody who has a completely false, you know, memory imprint, implant kind of thing, and they have to overcome it. She never doesn't know who she is in the moment.
Yeah.
Like, she understands in the moment, in the beginning, that she's missing memories and she'd like to get them back. She's not oblivious to it.
Yeah.
But it also doesn't paralyze her from acting. I mean, the first thing that she decides to do is wake up her mentor in the middle of the night and spar.
Yeah.
You know, because she just wants to work out her anxiety, her aggression, her energy, whatever. And so she's a character of action. Not necessarily always of deliberation, but of action. And that speaks volumes for what you see later and what we undoubtedly will see in future installments from the MCU.
True. And speaking of her mentor, like we said, her mentor in the film is Yon Rogg, played by Jude Law. And for as little screen time as Jude Law has, because he doesn't have a lot of screen time in the film, oddly enough. Like, there's a little bit in the beginning. There's like a covert mission that lasts maybe 5 minutes. And then he's like interspliced throughout the film in like phone calls.
Right.
But you don't see a lot of him. But one of the issues that a lot of people had was still trying to figure out who he plays in the film. Some people, because IMDb never really stated it prior to the film coming out.
Oh, gosh. It was the source of so much speculation over the past year plus.
It was like, oh, he's going to be Mar-Vell. It's going to be Mar-Vell. Or it's Yon Rogg. He's going to be, you know, the mentor. Or he's going to be someone else. He's going to be, you know. And honestly, I don't know too much about, like, I know about who Mar-Vell was because of the research into who that person is. But Yon Rogg doesn't really pop up as much as Mar-Vell. So, Chad, who was Yon Rogg in the comics?
Oh, gosh. I have very little knowledge from back that far. It's before I was born. I believe Yon Rogg was a Kree soldier that I think Yon Rogg might have been responsible for Carol's like kind of mind scramble deal.
Ah, okay.
But I don't quote me. I don't honestly know. I don't do homework for these things. I either know it or I don't. But in the comics, he presents as an ally and becomes a foe. I do know that much.
Okay.
So in, you know, true to form, the character presents as an ally and becomes something other than an ally over the course of this film. So at least to that extent, they've matched the arc, if you will, of that character.
Cool. Oh, I didn't. So that little bit that you just stated, I had no idea. So, see, there you go.
Let me back up into something that I'm pretty positive about and not, you know, put something forward that I don't actually know.
For the time that he was on screen, he was okay. I mean, Jude Law was nothing to write home about. Like, I think, and it just so happens to be the same mindset I have with a lot of choices that filmmakers make to put like really well-known performers in bit role parts just for the sake of saying, oh, well, so-and-so was in the film or this person is doing my project or whatever. I don't know if Jude Law was necessary for this particular role, but I mean,
was Robert Redford necessary for the Winter Soldier? No. But was it incredible that they got Robert Redford to do a Marvel movie? Absolutely.
True. Very true.
Well, plus, you know, he could always come back later.
That's very true. That's actually another good point. Yeah. All right. I retract my previous statement.
Also, just to kind of, since we were sort of talking about in the beginning, they're on the Kree homeworld. Holla. One of the things that they have changed from the comics that was a very good change was the concept of the Supreme Intelligence, which is the leader of the Kree. It's sort of this, in the comics, it's this ridiculously ugly,
blob,
obese, disincorporated thing. Head with multiple eyes and like tendril hair kind of stuff going on.
Oh.
And it lives in a tube, kind of like Zordon. Or it floats, you know, or whatever. So
there you go, Spence.
It's very unsightly. And just given the way that they've put things together in the MCU, it really still, even in like a Guardians of the Galaxy, it would still, it would be a sideshow rather than one of the driving points of the plot. And they needed it to be one of the driving points of the plot. So they changed kind of the nature of the Supreme Intelligence, I think, for the better. For visual reasons for the audience that wants to be seeing these movies and, you know, not throwing up into their popcorn.
It's true because the Supreme Intelligence appears to the individuals as a member of somebody or some person whom that person thinks fondly of or they care about deeply. So it's a very interesting concept and it's, you know, it is much more appealing to the eyes. As prior, I did get a chance to see like little blips of images of what it was supposed to look like, and I'm glad
it ain't pretty.
It looks like a giant piece of algae in a tube.
It's not good.
But with Jude Law's team, you get the individuals who are on that team, including Gemma Chan, who plays Minerva. You get Jamin Hansu's character, who plays Korath. From the, if you don't remember Korath, he's from the first Guardians of the Galaxy. And he's a part of this Strike Force or Star Force. Yeah. Lee Pace reprises his role as Ronan.
Ever so briefly.
Yes. Twice for a good 5-6 minutes altogether.
It's amazing how without that, like, black eye drizzle, I didn't notice it was him for a second.
Honestly, he kind of looks like the brother of the opera singer from The Fifth Element.
I actually thought he looked older in this. I'm like, isn't he supposed
I
to look
he looked
younger?
Baby face.
He was super younger in this one.
He looked older in this one. I looked at him like, okay, then it was just me. But you get a lot of those people who are part of Jude Law's team. You get these flashbacks that Carol Danvers has of these memories she can't quite put, where she keeps seeing Annette Bening's character, but she doesn't know who she is. Even as Chad mentioned, Supreme Intelligence appears to Carol as Annette Bening's character, but she can't put it. Like, why are you appearing in front of me? I don't even know who you are, is what she says in the
film. Obviously, this person meant something to me, but I don't even know who she was.
Yeah. So through the course of this
Hulk smash!
Wow. Through the course of this covert mission,
Eddie just took it upon himself to destroy half of our studio.
I did, and I actually feel good about it. She ends up on Earth through the course of this botched mission, looking for the Skrulls that have landed on the planet, who are looking for someone, and it just happens to be this Dr. Lawson, which is what they gather from checking out her brain. Brie Larson, Carol Danvers' brain, they find that, oh, her name is Dr. Lawson. So Carol decides that she's going to go after these Skrulls before they find that doctor and exterminate the Skrulls that are on the Earth, which there's like maybe 6 of them.
Which the Skrulls, for those of you keeping score at home, are the shape-shifting aliens.
Yes.
The green ones with the pointy ears.
Yes.
Also known as the old lady on the train.
Yes.
Such an amazing
for everybody's pop culture big reference, it's the old lady in the train.
Which, who originally was supposed to be a child.
Even better. I would love to see somebody smack down
No, that would have been amazing still, because then you have because as an old lady she had to fight back, so you'd still have like this kid like swinging around trying to beat up like this person. That'd be amazing.
Which it's so great in the scene when she's trying to fight the old lady and all these people are like trying to hold her back to keep her from like continuing to wail on this old lady. And then at some point when the old lady Skrull takes off, like she just shrugs them off like nothing. Like they're all trying to hold her back, and then Carol like just does like a little shrug and they all fall to the side. So that was pretty cool.
It was pretty cool.
But as she lands to Earth, she's also introduced to Nick Fury and Agent Coulson, which at the time they're both agents for S.H.I.E.L.D.
Coulson's a rookie.
Yeah, Coulson's pretty fresh on the Force, or whatever you want to call it. Nick has been a part of it at some time. And this is where you begin to see a lot of the CG renderings of their face, and which it's not as obvious as it has been before. Like, mm-hmm. they're continuing to progress that technology really well, because in this film, I could barely really see for Nick Fury, I could really barely see some of the lines that should have been there. For Clark Gregg, that was just a little bit more interesting.
It was more obvious because he's really not in it very much.
No, and that's one of the things that I was going to ask. Like, for me, I don't really think Coulson needed to be so, like, I don't know, maybe a small cameo might have been better, but for as much as he was in it, even then, it just seemed like a little bit overkill for me. I don't know. What do you guys think?
It certainly didn't have to be a recognizable face.
Yeah.
It could have been any S.H.I.E.L.D. agent. It didn't have to be Coulson. I think what matters is, the reason it matters that it was Coulson is because later on, chronologically, Coulson is the one chasing down these unique individuals. So it kind of gives him a reason for being in the loop with Nick Fury by the end of the movie.
Yeah.
In the beginning, when you first see him, there's really, it could be anybody. It doesn't have to be Coulson. I think it's based upon where you know, Agent X, whoever that would be, what that person ends up knowing by the end, in collaboration with Nick Fury, the one that makes the most sense is Coulson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that. It seemed like a waste with a lot of the scenes he was in. Like, there was no, he doesn't speak a lot, which unfortunately, due to the exposure that we have with the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show, he speaks a lot in those in that series. So going back to his role here and him just kind of being the quiet face in the background, like not really seeing him or hearing him as much, I don't know, it just kind of seemed like a waste of an opportunity for me. Like you said, it could have been just any agent, but I don't know.
Okay, but who's gonna listen to the loudmouth rookie? That's not a good way to get promoted.
I would. At the end, you find out, well, you know, they said I couldn't hack it, but my cousin's going to come in. His name's, you know, whatever Coulson's first name is.
Phil.
Phil. His name's Phil. Phil Coulson. He's going to be taking my place. Something like that. Like, that would have been good enough for me.
Yeah. I don't know how I feel about, like, oh, you're the family of the person that we like.
Exactly.
Because then it's just like, give us the person we like.
But why?
Well, and I mean that in the greater story, that character doesn't have enough of a role anyway. Like, they really are just sort of a secondary participant. Most of the story is Carol and Nick in this, like, pseudo road trip buddy cop deal in the 90s.
Yeah, and that's where that transition goes, where they're trying to figure out where this doctor is and whatnot. And pretty much, like Chad said, the whole buddy cop kind of, you know, journey begins. She's learning about him. He's learning about her. Nick Fury is very chummy in this film. Like, you can
tell. I love it. It's so good.
it was good. I mean, you can see. Here's the thing I can appreciate. You can see at this point of his career where he began to start creating, like, those boundary walls and, like, start becoming the director of S.H.I.E.L.D. that he later on takes on. So it's interesting. I don't know if it was, like, it's just a very interesting dynamic to see Nick Fury go back to being, like, this chummy, almost like how he was, like, in previous 90s and late 80s films, like seeing Samuel L. Jackson as that kind of a role, especially, like, when he's, like, being all cutesy with the cat and all that kind of stuff. Like, I don't know. I thought it was okay. Why did you like it so much?
It's just a different side of the character because, like, you know, I don't know much about him before he just showed up at Tony Stark's apartment and it's like, I want to talk to you about the Avengers Initiative. Like, you know, there's like a whole backstory to Fury that we don't fully normally get. And so this was kind of fun just seeing, like, you know, seeing him on the road to becoming the person he was, like you said. But I don't know. I just found him. It's just weird that, like, he's so serious normally, and then you just get a goofy version of him. It's just bizarre, especially once that horrible, horrible cat comes around. Like, he just becomes so goofy with it. It's great.
I think one of the things that I do have to compliment in terms of his role in the film is how well him and Brie Larson work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it just seems to they just seem to complement each other when they're in a scene together. Her kind of sassy responses and whatnot to his almost gruff, like almost going to be gruff, but not quite gruff mentality, and his jokes and her witty replies and whatnot. Like, it actually works. Like, mm-hmm. I think that dynamic would work. So I do have to compliment that. I'm not too sure if I'm fully on board with him being super, like, super silly, but I don't know. Yeah.
He's quippy, but you know, he's quippy in the other movies. He's just more reserved in mm-hmm. tone. Like, he says the quippy one-liners with all the rest of them. He says it with a sense of, like, maturity and almost like sometimes a weariness, but I think, you know, kind of making a younger version of that was really delightful. I mean, it was fun to see. And there's a lot to be said for, you know, if you're doing any kind of, not that I'm advocating a deep psychological evaluation, but if you're trying to really evaluate, okay, who is this Joker and why does he think that these powered people would be heroes, or like, why would he not be more hesitant to believe that they exist at all or whatever? He kind of just goes along with everything as presented, and I think it shows that he's got this, he has an open mind
mm-hmm.
for as secretive as he eventually becomes. He has an open mind. He's not afraid to test any theory or consider any possibility, and I think with Nick Fury, one of the things that you really get is his pragmatism, because he is willing to consider any option, and oftentimes the simplest explanation is the correct one. So he doesn't waste time with extra, like, investigations and let's sit you in a cooling tank so that we can figure out what's going on and then come back at you. Like, he really just goes with it in a way that is kind of a nice mix of, yes, professionally immature,
mm-hmm.
but also really explains where we see him later when he is approaching Tony Stark.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, because if he was more resistant to shape-shifting aliens and whether she can shoot blasts out of her hands or whatever, you know, then he wouldn't necessarily have ever tried to form the Avengers.
Mm-hmm. True.
So it really does provide kind of an elegant through line for him as a character, looking back to who he used to be so late in the telling of the story for the rest of us.
And I can agree with that. Like, that, I can see that making sense. Like, in terms of the overall story arc itself for the long run of the character. Like, it makes sense. And that kind of goes to, like, to the directors that are a part of this film. You know, we mentioned earlier the directors who also wrote the film, Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. They're not too new in the game, but they have been directing films since as early as, like, 2000s. They did actually a really good... They both directed a really great film that I actually really enjoy called It's Kind of a Funny Story, starring Zach Galifianakis and a slew of other individuals in it. But it's a really interesting film, and I think they actually wrote it, too. But I say that to say that... they wrote it. The mentality for that film is going into the psyche of an individual and recognizing that they have the ability within themselves to overcome what the world has already predetermined for them to kind of be in their status of life. Essentially, it's kind of a funny story, just real quick. It's pretty much about a clinically depressed kid who checks himself into a rehab because he says he's suicidal. And they put him in there for 48 hours, and for 48 hours, he's like, I'm actually fine. But he ends up meeting some of the other patients, one of them being Zach Galifianakis, and he kind of begins to see how his life is actually really well off as compared to others, and that he can find happiness and true joy if he begins to look inward and starts loving himself. So going back to Captain Marvel, a lot of what the film really strives for is recognizing how her being her is what makes her powerful, not so much her abilities or what she's been given or what she's being threatened with to get taken away. like her role on a team, none of that is what makes her so special or so powerful or so unique. It's her. Her being able to keep getting back up again and keep fighting, which those scenes were teased in the trailer. The scenes where like she is coming off of like a go-kart crash, or she's getting up from falling on the beach, or she's getting up from falling at basic training, which it sounds like she's got an equilibrium problem, but either no, but all these instances where she's chosen prior to, which she's forgotten all this, she's chosen beforehand to keep pushing forward. And I think a lot of that is just done with great storytelling, like with, like we said, Anna Bolden and Ryan Fleck, them imposing that mindset within this character to show, even though she is listed as the most powerful Marvel character, she is powerful not just because of her abilities as like this cosmic entity, but because she's truly herself as this role.
Well, she does go through a journey of sort of self-integration, if you will, because she does have fragments of memory and she doesn't know where they come from. She happens to essentially follow a lead to C-53, which is what the Kree call Earth. It's like the star chart designation for our planet or whatever. And she doesn't know when she gets here and crashes into the ceiling of the Blockbuster. She doesn't know that it's the planet that she's originally from.
Yeah.
So her whole journey is one of self-integration. And once that starts happening, you know, you learn things like, you know, that that governor, that control chip that you were talking about before, she was led to believe that it was what gave her the power.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And could be taken away. That's what her mentor told her repeatedly. But then you learn later that's not actually where the power is coming from at all.
Yeah.
It's like triggering her to stop using the power. It's a control mechanism, it's not giving power, it's taking power. And so she has to eventually overcome that training.
Yeah.
You know, so it is kind of, you know, whatever, you know, quote unquote story you've been told about your life, you know, you've got to really go for the truth. And in finding the truth, you will discover, you know, power, strength, resilience, you know, whatever, insert adjective here.
Yeah.
It's not really an adjective, but anyway, they're nouns when I form the verbs that, or the words that way. I'm going to stop talking like an English nerd. But, you know, so it is like that self-integration is the main arc for her character.
And mind you, she has help along the way. One of the characters we didn't get a chance to mention was her old partner, her flying buddy, Maria Rambeau, who is played by Lashana Lynch. She has such a key role, even though it's in the latter half of the film. She is one of the vital characters to Carol Danvers realizing that self-integration, that recognition of her own power within her, her ability to be the most powerful person she can be. Which there's a great scene where Maria kind of goes up to Carol and like just kind of reaffirms who she is and what she is, even before she had all the powers, like who she was and what she could do and the things that she would be destined to be, to, you know, to do in the future because of how powerful she was and whatnot. Like, it's a very empowering speech that she tells her. Like, I'm like, okay, like wiping my eyes. Like, it was good, because not so many times we look at some of these Marvel films or we look at superhero films and we think, okay, I would be so much better if I could fly, or I would be so much more stronger if I had an iron suit, or I would be so much of a this if I was born, or if I was bitten by a radioactive animal, or if I was, you know, whatever it may be, spider pig or whatnot. But whatever it is, we think, you know what, I would be this, I would be X if Y had happened, you know. And this film kind of helps create that foundation of, you know what, you are the most powerful you can be right now, even before you grow up and become, you know, a business person, you grow up and you want to be a firefighter, or you as the current state of your life right now, whether or not you choose to leave this theater and go and drive to McDonald's, or you go and drive wherever, you do whatever you do, you are the most powerful you can be right now. And you are what other people see as a hero. You can be that. You can be these things just as you. And I think that's one of the great things this film really does, and especially with Lashana Lynch's character really helping to solidify that mindset in that latter half of the film. It really brings a lot of that, like Chad was mentioning earlier, that story arc of her getting that self-integration into who she is and what she is. It rounds it out and makes that like story arcs much more resolved for me. I don't know.
Well, it does it in a very elegant, beautiful way too, because, you know, so often, you know, as people, we lose our way, whether because of our own choices or because of what other people kind of suggest to us or pathways that other people will lead us on. I mean, mm-hmm. you think of like, you know, your teenage years or your early 20s or whatever. And like, you know, when you first gain independence out of the household or whatever, and you know, there are a lot of things, there are a lot of influences around, and you might take a bit of a detour on your quote unquote path, and it really illustrates the power of, you know, close friends, family, whatever it may be, to speak into you still when mm-hmm. you think that you've gone too far, or you've lost yourself too much, or you literally don't have a memory of who you are, as is the case with Carol. And so she has this close friend. They're like sisters because they've gone through some trials together, and this woman knows her.
Yeah.
She doesn't know what's happened to her over the last 6 years or whatever, but she knows her from before, and she can speak in, you know, that truth. And I think there's something very relatable there.
Yeah.
You know,
maybe
I didn't get abducted by aliens and powered by the Tesseract, but I darn well do have people in my life who've known me for years.
Yeah.
And if I do, you know, get turned around and lose my way, like maybe they are an anchor point, you know, mm-hmm. and I think that human theme and that human relatability, I mean, you see it with Captain America and the Winter mm-hmm. Soldier, you know, Bucky, where he's like, I'm not going to fight you. You can kill me if you have to. I'm not going to fight you. I want you to know who you are.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, we've seen it before with other characters, and that's one of the things that really has always been a bright spot of the Marvel Comics universe is characters that have a certain relatability, no matter how powerful they are. And so it's nice to see that here, because Maria doesn't have any superpowers.
No.
You know, she's a superb human being. She's a fighter pilot, a single mom, like making her way and everything, and a good friend.
Yeah.
You know, but she's not like, you know, turning invisible or lifting things with her mind or anything like that, because you don't have to. Like, that's not the point of these stories necessarily.
No.
Is not to say you need to become a superhuman. Like, you need to be the best you can be, and not just for yourself. You need to be the best you can be for other people around you too. That's the heroic part, because you stand up for the little guy when he's down, you know, or if you are the little guy, Steve Rogers, you still stand back up and say, I can do this all day.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever it is. So having that echo of humanity in such a fantastical story landscape is very nice. Now, I will say her daughter, it's going to be a different story, people.
Is that
superpowers?
Yeah.
Yeah. That her daughter's character, if they follow through with that character, then we'll see that character again, whether it's played by the same actress or not.
Yeah.
Probably not, because we've jumped 30 years in the future. But
it's true.
But yeah, no, mom doesn't have any powers, at least in the comics that we know of. But the daughter sure does end up doing some special things, leading the Avengers even at one point.
Oh, wow.
Or maybe twice. Yeah. No, she's incredible.
Huh. Kind of rounding out this, there's a couple other standout things that I really wanted to kind of talk about. One of those was obviously Goose the cat. So
he's
one
not
of,
a cat.
He's not a cat. He's not a cat. He's a mother flurkin, because because it's so great how in the trailers, it does not do it justice as to how much Fury actually cares about this cat. And it's so, I think I have to admit, that was one of the more funnier parts for me, seeing Fury interact with this cat. And then there's a scene where Talos meets them, and you come to find out that the Skrulls are actually trying to figure out a way to find home, and so they need Carol's help to figure out this, the search for some type of engine. So, but Talos sees Goose and then freaks out, and then Nick Fury pretty much uses Goose as kind of like an intimidation type thing to keep putting in front of Talos, and Talos freaks out. He's like, "What? I don't know how you can have that thing on your lap," or whatever. And you come to find out that, yes, Goose is a Flurkin, which, if you're unaware what a Flurkin is an alien entity that actually can have certain pockets of, like, time and space within their body, so they can have several different, like, pockets throughout their self.
The thing's a monstrosity.
That thing was awesome. That is, like, I want a cat like that. Like,
no,
if I ever
why? Get a... Why would you ever want that? It would eat your house, and you would just not have a house.
I could just threaten the next realtor with, like, give me this house or my cat's going to eat it. Like, I don't know. It just looked cool. And the moment that you realize that Goose is actually all these things that Talos has been warning Nick Fury about, and when Nick Fury finally realizes it and sees it happen, he's like, oh, okay, I'm going to pick you up now. And just, like, his whole, like, demeanor changes about Goose. And I think that was one of the more funnier parts for me.
I've never seen a more horrifying image in a movie than this cat. I don't deal well with cats.
That's because you're allergic to them.
Yeah, but like...
Well, and because they're cats.
Yeah.
That's
cats
true.
Are something else, man. But this thing is just... Like, I thought it was just going to be a talking cat based on the trailers.
A talking cat?
Yeah, I thought it was going to be something lame. Not this horrifying Cthulhu-esque monster with tentacles that don't stop.
Yes. It was, H.P. Lovecraft would be proud.
It was bad.
Now... I know you.
Now, was this the subject of your epic post movie phone conversation?
No,
was the
no. So the since we're coming around to that, so the conversation that we had on the phone was in the perspective of where this film should have been placed in terms of the release in the MCU. Now, Spencer had spoken at length that this film should have been a part of Phase 1.
Because this feels like more of a Phase 1 movie to me. Like, I don't know what it is, but it feels like it fits more in with, like, Iron Man and the first Captain America rather than, like, Black Panther and Infinity War. Plus, as a personal preference, I'm not a big fan of, oh, let's set up this really major, like, arc, and then let's take a pivot to the 90s for some fun back there, and then you have to wait 2 months to get to the rest of the story that we were already in progress with.
Well, and so this is what I was saying is, here's the thing. If you would have done this at Phase 1, then all the events leading to Infinity War would not have... First off, it wouldn't have transpired this the way it transpired.
Why not?
Because Captain Marvel is... pretty OP, and she would have probably, like, photon blasted Thanos into the next universe and taken the gauntlet for herself.
Nah, they could have kept the story exactly the same, just move that one movie up and, like, mess around with a few end credit scenes. Because
but
I don't feel like...
she still would have killed, like, destroyed Thanos. Like, the bottom line is, she, as being this OP character in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, would have easily defeated all of the, like, things, the foes from every single film after the fact.
Yes, but like...
And then you would have had Civil War 2 as opposed to Civil War.
Okay, you can't have 2 without 1.
Like. Well, it's from the Civil War, the second part.
But like, I don't think that would have changed anything because Nick Fury's had that beeper the whole time.
Yeah.
Like,
and nothing was ever too large for his... for his team. Nothing was ever too large for his kiddos.
Well, like, plus, like, the stuff they've been dealing with thus far has been kind of on the small scale.
Yeah.
And the last thing you want to do is call Carol in for something that's kind of small potatoes and get a whole bunch of sass about how he still doesn't know when a real emergency is.
There's no guarantee that he's never used the pager before.
This is
that
true.
Is true. See, Spence, that is true.
Oh, you just... Oh, my God, Chad.
No, but that helps. So, I think the way this works better because you're at a point with the end of Infinity War where all hope is lost. Every supportive character that has ever been a positive force behind moving forward, such as T'Challa, such as Bucky with Steve Rogers, such as the dynamic with Scarlet Witch and Vision, such as, you know, Falcon, and a lot of them, like them being like a part of this positive force moving forward, progress, if you will, being gone. It's like this team that is left is just lost without any kind of direction. Now, if Captain Marvel had already been in the mix, it would have felt like, well, but, you know, Captain Marvel is there, so she'll just come in and fix everything in the next film. In this, at the end of this first film, my mindset was like, this is probably as bad as it's ever been in the cinematic universe. Like, this feels like this is doomsday right now. Apocalypse. Not DC character doomsday or apocalypse. I just mean the day of, you know, whatnot. Anyway, but I think the purpose of her being debuted now is to give credence, first off, the film, to give credence of a character that they have yet to reveal, showcase her power set, and then give the sneak peek of her coming back at a point where they're at the least bit of hope.
I think I kind of have to disagree with you on this, because if they wanted to do that, then it was a pretty bad idea to start releasing all of this, like, things that happened after Endgame. Like, oh, we're making another Spider-Man movie. Here's the trailer of
it. Well, okay, that's Sony's thing. That's not, Marvel had no say in that.
But it's part of their universe, though.
I was going to say, Nick Fury, Maria Hill.
Yeah, people who are gone, like, if you're just going to show them, like, that's, you're kind of just getting rid of that whole tension right there.
Hey.
And I really don't get why they do that.
That, I don't know. Like, I think that's a Sony thing.
The beautiful thing is, whenever you deal with comic book characters, like, the dead ones come back. They rewrite history. They retcon things. They go into the future. There is no zone of storytelling that's off limits.
Yeah.
It really is, like, a really cool realm of the imagination.
Uh-huh.
But even knowing that characters can come back from the dead, or they're going to go into the future or the past, or, you know, some new, bigger, better superhero is going to come into the limelight or the spotlight or whatever. The beautiful thing is, we're a month away, a little more than a month away from Endgame.
Yeah.
And we still have no ever-loving idea what is going to happen in that movie. I think that that is such a remarkable achievement.
Yeah.
I don't know who they've had to, whose arms they've broken, whose kneecaps they've, you know, kind of Tonya Hardinged, who they've blinded with mace, they've sprayed them so many times, like whose vocal cords got temporarily like severed and then reattached. I mean, I don't know.
Is this Marvel or the mob?
This is Disney. Oh, this is how they work. The Men in Black. But they've kept things so secret. And even now, you do, by the mid-credits scene of Captain Marvel, you do get an indication of kind of where she fits into the mix with some of the other more familiar characters.
Yeah.
But you still have no idea what's going to happen. Kevin Feige, Feige has said, we're not releasing anything in the trailers that doesn't happen in the first 20 minutes of the movie. Anything beyond the first 20 minutes, you're not seeing until you're in the theater.
Nice. And this movie is almost 3
obviously
hours long.
That doesn't count, you know, Spider-Man Far From Home, which chronologically, supposedly, takes place after Endgame. Mm. And Peter's back, Nick's back, Maria's back.
True. And mind you, that goes back to a Sony decision. Like, that's whatever contract they have with Marvel and whatnot, they decided, yo, we just, well, despite everything else, we're still going to put out this film.
Okay. Yeah, well, but then they've also, like, they've greenlit Doctor Strange 2, they've greenlit Black Panther 2, so it's like, they're coming back. We've all known that they're coming back, but how are they coming back? What do the other characters have to go through to get them back?
Yeah.
That's good storytelling, and we have no idea.
Yeah.
Well, people have some ideas.
Well, and just to kind of get on the little bit of a rabbit trail, not too much, but like rewatching the because we saw the Far From Home trailer when we went to go see the Captain Marvel film. Me and Chad, we saw the trailer for it. And rewatching it a second time, I've realized that Happy, played by Jon Favreau, says something very unique in the film. Like, you know, you're by yourself. You're all alone. You're this is not like he's making the statement as that there's nobody else here for you. And in all the previous films, you have this really strong relationship between Tony and, you know, Peter. And so it's interesting how if this takes place after the events of that, then I don't know. That can go like a whole introspective thing.
Well,
like
you've got all the stones. They can rewrite everything.
Pretty much.
I mean, it's, you know, and there's the architecture of, okay, you have an OP character like Captain Marvel and Doctor Strange saying in Infinity War, like there's only one thing that works.
Yeah.
So having Captain Marvel around before that one thing obviously wouldn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, if he can turn Mantis and Drax into some coils and blocks, you know, with the Reality Stone that thankfully he chose to reset them afterward. Didn't really matter for them. They dusted anyway, but you know, like he could do that to her. If she's powerful enough, she's powered essentially by the Space Stone.
Yeah.
He could use one of the other things to take her out and then dust everybody, you know? So I think it fits whatever grander story arc they're trying to fit her into. There's a lot of explaining still to do over what happens between the mid-90s and the present day, because she doesn't appear to have aged.
No.
Yeah.
No, which it kind of seems like it's going to be one of those like Interstellar type explanations, like how, you know, Matthew McConaughey and what's her name are on this planet and every minute is like months going by or something, years going by or something. It's really trippy, but like it might be something like that the way they explain it. Other highlights. Anybody here have any other highlights or any other issues with the film that you kind of want to speak towards? I know one of the things I just kind of wanted to highlight before we kind of rounded this conversation, the Stan Lee cameo. I just have to say, being a fan of Kevin Smith's earlier films and not really seeing a lot of Whatnot, seeing how there's a cameo in the film where Stan Lee is sitting on a bus. So it happens actually while the, or not a bus, the train. Mm-hmm. It happens in that scene where Carol is trying to hunt down this Skrull who looks like the old lady. But she passes by this gentleman who is reading a script, and on the script it says "Mall Rats." And he's saying that, you know, that iconic line, you know, something true believer, you know, but it's something very Stanley-ish. Like it's a line from the actual film. And the fact that, number one, they're able to still produce, which we found out they're also, he did a cameo for Endgame, but to still see him pop up in these films and then to see him doing something that's so iconic for his earlier career in appearing in Mallrats, and him no longer being a part of this world, unfortunately, him passing. It was really cool to see. And this is aside from like the new opener that they did for Stan.
We're not skipping that. That's the absolute highlight of this experience for me.
Yeah. Well, okay. Let me just kind of wrap this up and then I'll pass it over to you. But like just him doing that whole scene and then seeing Kevin Smith's reactions on Instagram. And he did a video today of his full reaction of that and him trying to hold back the tears, because we all know Kevin Smith, he's very emotional, and I know it makes sense why, but like for this particular thing for him, it really touched him and moved him, and for myself as well, being a fan of this film, Mallrats, it was great to see that as well. But to what you were saying, Chad, the other highlight that you had?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there was, maybe I missed, but like there was no hint of a whiff of a spoiler of any kind that they were changing the Marvel Studios opening slate with all the painted superhero characters and the film scenes inside the letter forms of the Marvel logo as it rotates around and all that. Like when this movie started, we saw it Thursday night, first screening.
Yeah.
When it started and it had Stan Lee as every component of what has become the it's an ever-evolving logo anyway, because they put, you know, newer film segments into it, you know, from time to time. But for them to have changed the entire thing around into this beautiful homage to the guy, albeit not by himself.
No, of course.
But the guy who is predominantly responsible for the majority of all the source material that started this entire cinematic universe. I thought it was the classiest, coolest surprise that they could possibly have done. Because without Stan Lee, there is no Marvel Comics universe as we know it. There certainly is no Marvel Cinematic Universe to be derived from that comics universe. So, you know, to take the opportunity to turn, you know, essentially like the Marvel Studios name into a prolonged homage to him.
Yeah.
Was super cool.
Yeah. That was really nice.
Yeah. I think. Well,
and deserved the applause that it got from audience.
I was just going to say, as soon as that title card, you know, closed out and right after that faded out, you see just in simple letters imposed on the screen says, you know, thank you, Stan.
Yeah.
Like everybody in our theater like erupted in applause. Mm-hmm. And much deserved, of course, for the man who helped pretty much pave the way for these types of stories to be told and to get out there and to be a regular part of our culture and whatnot. And it was super, like, it caught me off guard because I wasn't expecting to be emotionally engaged in the film even before the film started. And I'm like wiping my, I'm like, oh, that was good. Yeah, I got some of my eye chat. Hold on. Like, because it was touching. I mean, this is the man who pretty much helped create the road, if you will, for a lot of the favorite stories that we have today. So, yeah. Yeah. What about you, Spence? What did you have a highlight as well?
Nope. You guys covered like the good ones.
Oh, well, Nana Nana Boo Boo.
Any musical notes for us, Spence?
No. Actually, I really didn't notice anything that was original. I really only heard the 90s musical pickouts.
Okay. Yeah. I totally, and this is because after The Winter Soldier, which still stands as basically my favorite, although it's got strong contention from some other ones, I bought and downloaded the soundtrack for that. And so I don't remember what the point is in this movie where essentially Carol comes into her own fully and she's going to beat the bad guys and win for the good guys.
Yeah.
They put in like the Avengers theme. Like at first I thought this is the Captain America theme. And then I was like, no, this is the Avengers theme.
Yeah.
This is the Avengers musical cue that's here in this moment where she's like really rising into her own fully and completely. So I thought it was really cool because they did kind of stick, maybe not an original composition. I think it was probably composed around, but it was definitely there. Like the musical cue was there. And I thought it was pretty cool because it was just a super recognizable music moment. Aside from all the other, like the song selections that were fun.
Great. Now I have to buy the official motion picture soundtrack. Thanks, Chad.
You're
Thanks.
Welcome.
And purchased. Yeah, like I remember hearing it while the film was going, and I was like, that sounds familiar, but I wasn't gonna place it because it was when, you know, the action was really getting up there, so I wasn't gonna spend too much time on it. But yeah. Well, like we said, rounding this conversation out, let's go ahead and go around the table and see, does the film pass or fail? And how many monocles? Let's go ahead and start with Spencer.
This film passed for me. It was fun to watch, like, you know, older Nick, younger Nick Fury, and just see what Captain Marvel is all about. So I'm going to give this one a 4 out of 5.
This film passes for me. I enjoyed it. I love the story it told. I love the impact this film is going to have on so many people who go and see it, even if they're not fans of the comic. They're going to become fans of this character in this cinematic universe, and they're going to root for this team and what happens next in Endgame because of who this character is and what she stands for. And so I'm anxious to see how it's going to incorporate in the next film, and I'm anxious to see the dynamic of that team and how it's going to work. seeing as, like Chad said, she's very headstrong, much like Iron Man, but she's also very much like she stands up for who what she believes in and whatnot, like Captain America. So it's going to be an interesting dynamic. So the film passes, and I'm going to give it a 4.5 out of 5. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the story. I really loved the way this film ultimately translated the message overall. And I honestly, I want to see Endgame, but I also want to see a sequel to what's going to happen with this character's own personal story as well. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I give it a 4.5 out of 5.
I honestly can't wait to see if they don't do something in Endgame between Captain Marvel and Rocket or Captain Marvel and Nebula, because they are spacefaring characters. Yeah. So they might have encountered each other before.
Well, and in the comics, so just side note, in the comics, Captain Marvel did a stint with the Guardians of the Galaxy. Yeah. And there's a whole short run in that series where Rocket finds out that the cat that she has is actually a Flurkin, actually puts it out to the universe saying that, you know, hey, there's a Flurkin on board of this ship, trying to get rid of it because it's actually a rare alien. And then the Flurkin actually has babies in one of the rooms. And it's a whole storyline. It was actually kind of fun.
Spencer's having nightmares already. He's like, the Flurkin has babies.
It's Flurkin awesome, Spencer. You can't take that away.
I will say this film passes.
Uh-huh.
I will also give it a 4.5. I really want to give it a 5, but the bar is so ridiculously high.
It is.
With these movies, I would give the opening homage a 5.
Oh.
For sure. Just on its own as a company title, essentially. Yeah. Like, that's the best I've seen.
Oh, yeah. And you know they're going to keep that for
more
at
because
least a
of the sentimental reasons, yeah. Right? Like, not because it's the best designed title you've ever seen, but I mean just everything that it means and the tip of the hat that it represents. Yeah, I really enjoyed the movie. I'm so glad we don't have to wait long for the next movie. Like, seriously, it's not even the summer; it's late April. It's like next door, and I'm giddy beyond anything.
Well, that about wraps up another awesome conversation here on the Filmosphers of Captain Marvel. Let us know your thoughts if you've checked out the film, if you've seen it. Obviously, we didn't mention the end credit scenes because those are gems for you. You should check those out. They're really great. They're really fun. And yeah, those are something that you should really see in the film. There are two end credit scenes, one pre-credit or one post-main
mid-credit,
and then one post-credit. So. Let us know your thoughts. Drop us a line on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or on our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you liked it, if you didn't like it, or if you think Spencer needs a haircut. Either way, let us know your thoughts.
My hair's pretty short.
just
this is uncalled for.
It's flirking awesome, Spencer. I love
Stop!
It. a couple upcoming weekend releases. We got Yardy, which is the directorial debut by Idris Elba. That debuts this Friday. We got Captive State, and we have the animated film Wonder Park. So, if you get a chance, check out any of those films, or just go ahead and see Captain Marvel if you haven't seen it yet, or if you need to see it again.
Let's get to that half a billion mark.
Exactly. this was an awesome episode, so we can't wait to talk to you again. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Chad.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.
Yeah.